Conference number 25, 7:30 p.m., Saturday, June 29, 1985. Father Hugo.
Our little congregation grows smaller. We diminish day by day. I'm reminded of the young lady who complained about her congregation diminishing, getting smaller. She says, it's getting so small now that every time the minister turns around and says, dearly beloved, I blush. So, now we'll begin with a prayer. We have one that I think should be here, is not here. I don't know what happened to her, but we'll begin with this prayer. Our final prayer, really, the one I'd like to use now as we begin this last meditation, is the one we use at Compline. Now that that's dismissed by servant. But we'll save that for afterwards. We will have Compline this evening, but we'll have it without music. We'll just recite it together. No hymn, just recite it shortly as a night prayer. After we come down in the front of the chapel, so we can do it together. And so that will be our final prayer. It's a beautiful prayer. And here's one that's a beautiful prayer too, but it's a private prayer by Cardinal Newman. I had one this afternoon, here's one this evening. I think it's a lovely prayer to which we wish to be close. O Lord, support us all the day long until the shadows lengthen and the evening comes and the busy world is hushed. And the fever of life is over, and our work is done. Then in your mercy, grant us a safe lodging, and a holy rest, and peace at the last. Now maybe I better repeat that for the benefit of our sister Florence. And that, well, I say it's a beautiful prayer, and it won't hurt to hear it once more. Well, Lord, support us all the day long, until the shadows lengthen and the evening comes and the busy world is hushed and the fever of life is over and our work is done. Then in your mercy, grant us a safe lodging and a holy rest and peace at the last.
So we come to our final conference. Tomorrow's conference will simply be a wrap-up. As I said, we'll not attempt any new material. Really, this is not new. It's a review, gathering together tonight. It's called the Day of the Lord, Judged on Love, I think the chapter is entitled. The Day of the Lord. We'll speak of the end of life. It's a very dismal subject, many think. But every day in our liturgy, we say, were you listening this week? With a pious coma, or were you listening clearly? Every day we say right before the communion, we await with joyful hope for the coming of our Savior, Jesus Christ. Joyful hope. We should look towards the coming of the Lord, the last end, with hope. If our conscience is right, then we cannot do otherwise than look with hope. There was a time in the church. Now, this is what we're going to do. We're going to look at the four last things, as they're called this evening. Eschatology, it's called. E-S-C-H-A-T-O-L-O-G-Y. That means that's a branch of theology. Theology is divided into segments, and this is the last segment, the last thing. That's what eschaton means, the last. It's a common enough word in religious literature, so it's a good word for all of you to know, even if you don't use it often. Eschatology. The four last things are death, judgment, heaven, and hell. And we will speak of them all this evening. But what I started to say before is that we have an unhappy look on the last judgment. It comes to us, I guess, from the Middle Ages. They had a different spirit, and you recall it, those of you who are old enough, there may be a couple here, remember the old black masses, the funeral masses we had in the black masses, And that song we sang in there, Dia Zire, that was a grim thing, you know, the last day of wrath, day of judgment. You know, that was the spirit of it. It was warning of it. And it did not have this spirit that we see in this prayer that we have. If we are right with God, why should we fear the last judgment? You know, we should look forward to it, eager, like the psalmist says, like pants, as the heart pants after living fountains of water. So we should pant. Scripture is filled with thoughts like that. St. Paul, I wish to be dissolved and to be with Christ. What a beautiful way of putting it. Dissolved like a pill in a glass of water. Because we're nothing without Christ. So we'll look at the four last things. Death, judgment, heaven, and hell. And we'll make this like a vigil for death. Not an unhappy one or a grim one or a gruesome one, but as a preparation for death. Let's imagine you're going to die tonight, tomorrow. Maybe some of you had that experience. It's a good experience to have. I had it a few years ago. It's a good experience to have. It's something you don't forget. You think you're going to die and you have to reflect. So we'll do that tonight and do it all night. This will be a night of meditation. Again, it shouldn't be an unhappy one. Lay on your cot, as it said in Psalm 63, I think we pointed out the other day, and you can't sleep, well, pray. And pray along these lines. So this should be a last real meditation. We're all going to die someday. We don't know when. We don't know how. And we should be ready whenever it happens. We always keep postponing it, that preparation. Like a man who is faithless to his wife, and she keeps begging him, come back, dear. Come back, dear. And then he wives her and says, I'll be back one of these days when I'm ready to die. He'll give her his companionship whenever he's finished. So that's what we say to God. We'll come back whenever we're ready to die. But now is the time of salvation, the scripture says, and so it should be now. We should always live with that thought not too far from our mind and the readiness to die, so that we will be found ready when God wants us to do that. Death, judgment, heaven, and hell. Now death. We won't have to say much about death. Death thanatology. The study of death is called thanatology now. It's a sort of a popular study for a while. There was a woman, Dr. Kubler Ross, who was quite an expert in death. She created the fad, and now she's apparently left it discredited, but the fad has persisted, and people studied death. Actually, they didn't study death because we don't really know what happens after death. We can only go up to the moment of death. Undoubtedly, what their purpose was, at least that was, I heard her speak at one time, and it was the idea of preparing people for death and to help the people in the family prepare them for the death of a loved one and to see how they could help them to die. But it had nothing about after that. Anyway, during this time of this literature, there was one book came out of it. It was a symposium, a number of books in one, a number of long articles in one, and I got it. It was on death, and it had a little introduction in it, and it says, the one thing about death that we know certainly is that we know nothing about death. I had paid $5 or so for the book, and this was a disappointment, but I closed it, and I never opened it again. What's the use? See, if there's nothing to learn, what's the use? And that's about it. We know nothing after death. And I don't think we need to be too curious about how it is to die. One man that wrote one of these books at the time, Joseph Alsop, a well-known newspaper man, he was dying of cancer, and he wrote a book while he was dying of cancer. And he says, there comes a time when a man wants to die, just like a man, when he's sleepy, wants to go to sleep. That's about as good a summary as you can make it. Maybe those people aren't so worried about dying. Maybe they want to die. I think there's a lot of elderly people who die, want to die today. They are asking it for the right to die themselves, to take their own lives even. And I'm not necessarily approving that, but people do get tired of life. They have nothing more to live for. We do have, if we lose this world, we have another better one coming. It would be the Catholic way of thinking that. We have to prepare for that other one and be ready for it.
For death.
I mentioned Simone Weil, and she's a very original writer. Whatever she writes about, she throws a new light on it. I recommend her to your attention sometime. And she takes old subjects and she gives them a certain newness. And she says about death, she was a Jew now, Jewish. She was never brought up a Jew. Her parents were neglectful Jews, but she was a Jew. And she had some of that tradition, and this remark remains that. I never allowed myself to think of a future state, but I always believed that the instant of death is the center and the object of life. I always believed. That's probably part of her Jewish background, because you know that Moses didn't know anything about a future life, and Abraham and all these people. They died with only the knowledge of this world. The idea of immortality does not appear in the Old Testament even. And the idea of resurrection only appears very late in the Old Testament. In the book of Daniel, that's a late book. The Old Testament, in the book of Wisdom. So that by the time of Christ, we hear Martha saying that I know that we will rise at the resurrection of the dead. The good pious Jews knew about the resurrection, but they didn't know it in the beginning. You'll often notice that in the Psalms. Maybe the Psalms puzzle you. They talk about after death as though nothing happens after death. Nobody can do anything until after they die. They carved a shield, a grave. And if they had any ideas about it all, they were very crude. Appeared once or twice in the Old Testament. So anyway, this is her background of Judaism. And it's interesting to know that a man like Moses lived the kind of a life he lived, apparently, without looking forward to any heavenly reward. He did it just to carry out the integrity of his life here before God. And this is what she is saying here. I always believe that the instant of death is the center and the object of life. That ends it all. We have one life to live. I used to think that for those who live as they should, it is the instant when, for an infinitesimal fraction of time, pure truth, naked, certain, and eternal, enters the soul. Your truth, naked, certain, and eternal, enters the soul. This is the moment of truth. At this moment, she's saying, we can look back and we see our lives whole. That's a good thing to do. And what will we see? Will we see something beautiful or something ugly? Has our life been a work of art? Like Gandhi speaks of, making the art of living. He didn't speak of moral theology, but of the art of living. Will we look back and see something beautiful, or will we see something hideous, on the other hand, or something in between, spotted and ugly, but not fully beautiful? It's time to think about that now, you see, so that when we do look back over our shoulders, whenever we're threatened with death, and you have to look back over your life, that you won't be frightened, that you'll be able to be happy with what God has done for you during your lifetime. And that's what we can do with death. And that was my experience. You look back over your life, and you really see it. They say when a man is drowning, he sees his whole life. I think when you're dying, or you think you're dying, why, you see your whole life before you. And then you wish maybe there's some things in that life you can change. Some perhaps you can change if you survive, but there's some you cannot change. It takes forever. And especially what you've done to other people, perhaps. You can't, no more time for reconciliation with your neighbor or with your enemy. It's too late now if you've waited this long. So, it's important then that we take care of these things while we have the opportunity, before it's too late. How often we wait till it's too late before some good action, some charitable action, we postpone it, and then the person's dead or gone somehow, and we can't do it. So, death is that. It puts a sort of a frame around our lives so that we can look at it The church never canonizes anyone until after their death. We have a way of canonizing people during their lifetime. Sometimes it may not bear up, because even the way we die is part of life, and the last living act we do is whether we surrendering our lives to God. Remember Jesus said, any man who comes after me must give up father, mother, sister, brother, and life itself. And so we must offer our life back to God. This is the last thing we do before we go into the great oblivion, before death, before we lose the use of our mental faculty. And we should be prepared to do this without resentment, with faith and with love. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away, and now He's taken away life. And we should be willing to give Him that back, the gift that He has given us. So that's about all we can say about death. A modern theologian, Benedictine, his name escapes me for the moment, but he says that that eschatology is the least satisfactory part of theology. He doesn't explain that, so I can't explain exactly what he meant in his own mind. Aylward Graham, he's not so well known now. I think he's still alive, but he was a somewhat well known writer in theology back a while. He says then that eschatology, the study of the last things, is the least satisfactory. I don't know. I puzzle over it. And I think it is, because really, it's true, we don't know anything after death. There's not much use talking about it. There's very little we know, and what we do know is in faith. The moment of death is when we make the last great leap of faith. If faith is a leap, then this is the last moment for the leap of faith. Confident in God, confident in His love, leap into the final darkness, following our lives, that there is someone there to receive us. Are you there? Pigley calls out in the play. Are you anybody up there? Are you listening? Can you hear me? And so this is what we do in that last moment. Are you there? Are you ready for me? I'm going to jump. The last great leap of faith. But you see, because it's the last great leap of faith, we don't know anything beyond it. But actually, I don't see why he would say it's the most unsatisfactory part of the Christian religion, because we're always supposed to be living by faith. We're supposed to be leaping through life all the time by faith. It's a game of leapfrog. Every instant we saw is one in which we should be living by faith, and faith is always mysterious to us. It never satisfies our mind. And so, I don't think in this respect it differs from the rest of our lives. Whether you want to consecrate your life to God and to Jesus Christ now, that's a leap of faith. You're going to deny yourself the world to do that. Are you ready to deny yourself the world and all the things of the world? And the pagan says, no, you don't want to. But if you really believed it, you would. So, for me to live is Christ, and to die is gain, St. Paul says. That would be the way he made his leap of faith. For me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. And this is the spirit that we should have and cultivate, and would result from living close to God during this world, living in union with God. Now, there are some things we know about after death, and they're in the Scripture, and we can follow them there. I'm going to mention a couple of them. One of them is in St. John, the letter of St. John, the first letter of St. John, chapter 3. Now, this is a passage which is read on the Feast of All Saints. And it also links the Feast of All Saints with the Feast of All Souls. That's the time of the year. That's the time of the last part of the year, is the time when the church's liturgy is based on eschatology, on the four last things. And We speak a lot about the eschaton then, the church's harvest time at the end of the year. And Jesus separates, the judge comes to separate the good wheat from the bad. This is the judgment. So, St. John has a word about that in the third chapter of his first epistle. He says, we've used this before. See what love the Father has bestowed on us in letting us be called children of God. And that is what we are. He said it's not just an honorific word, but it's a fact that we are children of God. Dearly beloved, we are God's children now. What we shall be later has not yet come to light. See, he says we don't know anything either. But we do know that when it comes to light, we shall... Now, he mentions three things that we do know now. So here's three things we know after death. We know that when it comes to light, we shall be like him. Well, remember, we were told long ago by the Sermon on the Mount that we should be holy like God is holy. We were told that at the beginning. That's the purpose of our life. And if we've achieved our purpose, then we shall be like him. It follows. Because we shall see him as he is. That because is interesting and important. We shall be like him because in order to be like him, we must know him. And to know him, we have to have a quasi-equality with him. Remember, this was why we speak of grace as a sharing in the divine nature. This is why we speak of children. We're children of God because we share the divine nature. This is why we're spouses of God and of Christ, because as children, sharing the divine nature, we have a quasi-equality with God. Because grace somehow gives us a share in divine life, and although we remain creatures, we do share this divine life. How that is one of the mysteries of our religion, and we're going to try to explain it this evening. But that's the act of faith that we must make, we're asked to make, that we do share this divine nature. We shall see him as he is, because we shall be like him, because we shall see him as he is. Remember we said, love demands equality. Love presupposes equality. And to see God as he is, we must be like him. St. Paul used a little different phrase. He says, we shall see him face to face. Face to face. We shall embrace him face to face. As lovers embrace one another. As human lovers embrace one another. We will see God face to face. And to see him face to face, to love him as love one another, then we have to have this equality. So we shall see him, we shall be like him because we shall see him as he is. And then the third thing that he says, everyone who has this hope in himself purifies himself even as he is pure. And this is why, therefore, our whole life is a trial and a process of purification. We shall see him as he is. And if we haven't completed the purification in life, why, we has to be completed before we can enter into the kingdom of heaven. We saw this afternoon, without holiness, no one can see God. And that text may be translated, and is translated in two ways. He who has this hope will make himself holy as he is holy. Or another translation is the one we just read. He who has this hope will purify himself even as he is pure. So this is the process of life, and this is what we know of life after death. We ought to remember, too, that what we're looking forward to is not merely immortality, but resurrection. That's very different. We sometimes get them confused in our thinking. But our hope is that we do rise with Christ, that we share this divine life, his risen life already, and that we will rise with Christ and share his glory. This is Christian faith. And Immortality is something quite different. It means just extending our lives here the way it is. It means we live in eternity with all the aches and pains we've got here, and maybe worse. What part of your life would you want to, if you were going to be immortal, what part of your life would you choose to be immortalized in? Infancy? And never mature? Adolescence? Old age? Would any of us want to be the way we are in old age? Forever and ever and ever? And sometimes, especially the way, the pitiable way and pitiable condition of the elderly, would we want to perpetuate that? It would be worse than death itself. So we're not looking for immortality. We're looking for resurrection, a complete renewal. This is our faith and our hope. This is what this leap should mean. We often mistake the resurrection for resuscitation. But resurrection is not resuscitation. Resuscitation, just a corpse is reanimated. That's not resurrection. Lazarus rose from the dead, but he really didn't rise in our sense of the word. That was just resuscitation. That's a sort of a sign to us of what God will do. But that's not really resurrection. St. Paul gives us the only good example that we can. It's like a rebirth. It's like being hatched again from an egg. It's like the butterfly that comes out of the chrysalis. A chrysalis that is a tomb of the worm, and it's the womb of the butterfly. And so that's the way it will be with us. That's about the best example we can get, the best image. A rebirth and an altogether new kind of thing is what St. Paul tells them. And then we wish this resurrection means in heaven means a complete transformation about which we talked early. We compared that to the metamorphosis of the butterfly from the caterpillar by means traversing through that chrysalis or that cocoon. The cocoon is a coffin to the worm and the womb to the butterfly. And so this is more like the picture as far as we have in faith of the resurrection. That is an entirely new thing and a transformation. Transformation. We are to be like him. Now, from this point of view, having arrived this, we can review our God's whole plan of existence for his universe, as well as for ourselves. The minerals of the universe are gathered up into plant life. The plants are gathered up into animal life. Plants, minerals, plants and animals are gathered up into human life. You see, there's a gradual ascent towards God throughout nature. We might call that assimilation. Assimilation. A-double-S-I-M-I-L-A-T-I-O-N. We use that word frequently whenever we speak of food. We say we must assimilate our food. What does that mean? That means when you eat a chicken, the chicken becomes you. It becomes human. It becomes human flesh. When you eat spinach, the spinach becomes you. Whenever a rabbit eats the lettuce becomes the rabbit. The fertilizer you put on the ground go into the lettuce, the mineral fertilizer. Then the lettuce becomes the rabbit. Actually, it becomes identical with the rabbit. It loses its own identity and becomes a rabbit. It's lifted one step up in the universe. And when the rabbit is eaten, why, it becomes the human being, the farmer, or the hunter. And we are to become like God. We are assimilated to God. That's what that word assimilation comes from. That was St. John says, to be like God, to be like him, to be assimilated to him. And this process of assimilation goes through the whole universe. It reveals something of God's plan to us. So here's a little poem. This came from a book about Gandhi. It's come, therefore, from a Hindu poet. I died as a mineral and I became a plant. Here's the process. What did I lose? Nothing. I gained. I'm up one step in the universe. I died as a plant and I became an animal. What did I lose? I lost nothing. I'm another step up in the universe. I died as an animal and I became human. What did I lose? I gained another step. Now that's where the little poem ends, but I added another line to it. So now it will be a really immortal poem. I died to my human destiny, to my human desires, to my human wishes and motives, and I became a share in the divine life, a child of God and a spouse of God, in a kind of quasi-equality to God. I have become like God. And that is what St. John says we must do to enter into eternity. So here's the process of life. And it comes through this process of change. You know, whenever the little piece of lettuce, a little lettuce leaf is just sitting quietly in the garden and it sees the rabbit coming and looks up and says to the rabbit, well, there, rabbit, what are you looking at me there rather hungrily? What's on your mind? Well, says the rabbit, I love you, dear. See? And then he bears his teeth. And the well says, little lettuce leaf, I think I'd rather not be loved. Well, I'm going to make a rabbit out of you. Well, if you're going to use those things, I'd just as soon remain here just a little lettuce leaf. See? But no, the rabbit says, I love you, dear. And so he assimilates the lettuce leaf. Now the farmer comes out on the porch with his gun, and he sees the rabbit. And the rabbit says, good morning, boss, what have you got there? Well, you know, how would you like to be a human being? How would you like to be a farmer? I have a new destiny for you. You're going to be a farmer. Well, that's a great honor, wonderful. And then he lifts the gun up and he aims it. Well, wait a minute, what are you aiming out at me for? Well, I have to assimilate you. And so he shoots the rabbit, and he assimilates the rabbit, and now the rabbit would not be recognized by its own mother anymore. He's a farmer, walking about the farm, you see. And then God looks down upon the farmer, and he says, I love you, I want you, I want you to be my child, I want you into my home. Oh, that'd be a wonderful honor, but I've got to assimilate you, and just as in the case of the rabbit and the lettuce leaf, you've got to die in order to live. That's the law of life. You must die to your human tendencies, your human desires, your human destiny, in order to live in the divine level. And that means you have to die to all these human desires and attachments that you have. So it is this process, this is what St. John means when he says, he who has this hope in him purifies himself as he is pure, as God is pure. The whole of life becomes a process of purification, therefore. And this is the reason for the afflictions in life. This is described in those sections of the Bible which are called apocalyptic. Maybe you never paid much attention. We don't put much emphasis on them. Certain stages and ages that people have. Those apocalyptic passages, you'll find an apocalyptic passage towards the end of each of the three synoptic gospels. An apocalyptic means revelation. And the revelation here is the revelation of man's last end and the accompanying suffering. What the Bible shows is that this has to be accomplished by suffering, just as the lettuce leaf becomes a rabbit by suffering and the rabbit becomes a human being by suffering. This same process is continued. So for us to be assimilated to God and become divinized means we must die to the human in us, as we've been talking all along. And this is a painful process for us. We would rather remain here, boss, if you don't mind, you know. I'd just rather remain human, but we can't. We're under a law of growth, and that law of growth demands that we die in order to live, in order to rise again. And this is then the process. And this is the reason for that kind of apocalyptic language. It talks about the stars falling and the sun coming down and all kinds of horrible things coming, you know, the story of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, death and famine and whatever they are, all these things are coming. And we think that's dire and that'll never happen. It's been happening right along, preparing the world. In our century, we've had two world wars, and we are pretty well assured that the third one will be the end of it all. You know more. There's been this accumulation. So, and if we knew any Jews, for example, in the Holocaust, we wouldn't be able to say to them that this scriptural language is exaggerated. We scream when we suffer from a pinpoint sometimes. Pinprick. We think we're there with hurt, you see. In the hospital, I thought I was being tortured. You see. So these are all sort of samples of the kind of suffering that God has proposed and sees as the way in which we become purified. And so these apocalypses are not imaginary. We may have to go through that too. We don't know what we'll have to go through. 40 million, 100 million people killed in the Second World War. Not counting all the peasants that were murdered in Russia, the Kulaks, and the Ukrainians. Apocalyptic language would not seem exaggerated to them or to the boat people that were put out of Korea and then of Cambodia out in the ocean all by themselves just to float away and die, survive if they could. These are apocalyptic events, and we see the world is filled with them. And so God, Jesus uses, even He uses these events to show us the type of purification that we must go through to be perfect. Without holiness, you cannot see God. That is a very important principle. We think we're just going to breathe in the casuals. But it ain't going to happen that way. This is why we have to realize that heaven is not right next door to hell. It's way above limbo. It's way above natural happiness. That's why we need to keep the natural level and limbo in that picture of ours. So that we rise above nature. We can still live a natural life, but we must rise above that natural life in order to enter heaven, which is supernatural. So this is our destiny. Yeah, there's a new poem by Newman that brings out very graphically, I think, the kind of purity that we need to enter the kingdom of heaven. It's called The Dream of Gerontius. It has also been set to music. If any of you are music lovers, you can get it on records. It was set to music by a great 19th century composer, Edward Elgar, who was a contemporary of Newman. And so it's a beautiful meditation in music. So theological, Newman was a great theologian. But Gerontius is the name of an old man. And it was probably Newman himself. He was 65 when he wrote the poem. He was thinking of the last things himself. But Gerontius is a man who lived like Newman would like to live, a holy life. He's at the very moment of his death as the story opens. He's dying as the story opens. His family's around him and his friends. They're all gathered around, the priest is there, and they're saying the prayers of the dying. We used to have rather an elaborate set of prayers for the dying. They disappeared with the council. But they were beautiful, but they were too long. They were too talky. But there was a beauty about them, and the people got used to them. They liked them. So Gerontius is dying, and he dies just at this moment, and the story is about his flight to the throne of God. He's been eager for this. Like St. Paul, he had wished to die, to depart and to be with Christ. And how could you describe it swiftly in a deathbed? Well, around the deathbed, you hear the people singing the songs of the church and the hymns of the Black Mass, the funeral mass, and saying the prayers. And meanwhile, the guardian angel, Gerontius, the guardian angel, comes to greet him and meet him and to carry him into the kingdom, to take him there, to lead him there. And now they go through the 9 choirs of angels. They go through the various choirs of heaven. Like the levels of heaven are the 9 choirs of angels that are enumerated by St. Paul. And as they go, they're greeted by the angels. Each choir of angels greets Gerontius as they go up. The demons are in there too, and they greet him, but they greet him with all kinds of cacophony and cursing and ugly sound, you see. But Gerontius ignores them all in the guardian angel. They go past him, ignore even the good angels with their beautiful song. Many of Newman's beautiful hymns come in those songs. Like, what's one of them that we all know? We sing it here a lot. Well, I don't think of the title, but that's where it comes in. He's composed it for those angels who are taking Gerontius up to heaven. And so finally, Gerontius bursts into the throne room of God. You see, the eagerness of a lifetime concentrated in an instant, and he goes and throws himself before God, and all of a sudden, he shrivels up like an ash. He falls down, screaming to God, calling him to let him, to free him from the divine presence. He, without holiness, he cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. Only the holy can see God. And even though he's been a holy man, there's still imperfection in his life, still selfishness in his life, still paganism there, still faults, not sins, but those faults against charity. And so he cannot stand the sight of God. And he asked to be sent back and to be given a new chance. This is Newman's way of talking about purgatory. This is what purgatory is, to give us that last chance to clean off the final imperfections, the final shortcomings of love, so that we will be truly ready to enter the kingdom of God. It's, I think, a dramatic way to convey to us the fact that we do need to be absolutely holy, not just good lies, but holy without blemish, to enter into the presence of God and to embrace God and to live with Him face to face, to see Him as He is, as St. John says. That is, of course, you might say it's a theory. It comes from that idea, Newman borrowed that from a theologian, and it happens, and you'll be interested to know, it was a woman theologian, St. Catherine of Genoa. In our time, a few women theologians have been getting some recognition. And St. Catherine of Genoa formed the doctrine, taught the doctrine, that purgatory is nothing else than the very love of God burning out the last vestiges of imperfection, that is, of want of love, from the soul. They're not material flames. It's not that kind of suffering at all. The suffering will be the flames of the spirit. And to remove that last. And it's the very love of God is the flame that does it. But it's all the more searing and deep and effective because it is the love of God. Now that is not a doctrine of the church. But there are lots of doctrines that are taught by saints that are not doctrines of the church, but when the church tolerates them, why, they have some value. So the church has never rebuked or rejected this teaching of Catherine of Genoa. And see it, and Newman, who was a great theologian and a very perceptive spiritual mind, accepted it, and that's a good argument in its favor right there. So I think we can take it that that is probably as close as we can get to understanding what purgatory is, that it's the very love of God, you know, in its flames, searing the soul and removing from it any want of love. Because we must love God with our whole heart and our whole soul and our whole mind and our whole strength to enter into the kingdom of heaven. Now this brings us to another text which tells us something we know about God. And that text is in St. Matthew's Gospel, chapter 25. We referred to it before, the steps of charity, but now we see how important those steps of charity are. When the Son of Man comes in His glory, this is a preview of judgment. We said death, judgment, now we're on judgment, and heaven and hell. Now we'll see what heaven and hell are too, right from the scriptures. He will sit upon His royal throne, and all the nations will be assembled before Him, the whole human race. There's a gigantic picture of this on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel in Rome. People go to see that. Maybe some of you have seen it. It's being refurbished now, and they hope to restore it to almost its pristine beauty within a short time. So maybe some of you younger people get back to Rome. I don't have the hope of seeing that, and you'll see the Sistine Chapel. I saw it once. And no, this is not on the ceiling. This is on the apse of the Sistine Chapel. And Christ is seated in the middle with God the Father.